Dear students, welcome at the fourth lecture of the Network Science course. You should first open the PowerPoint slide file PhD SEM 4. And if you opened it, then you should see the first slide as a title slide, Networks and Stability, Part 4, Network Noise, Sync and Engineering. If you just push your forward button to the next slide, then you will see examples for the stochastic resonance. I was introducing you stochastic resonance in the previous lecture, in lecture 3, so go back please to the end of this previous lecture if you haven't listened to that. I'm just giving you now a few examples of this sensitization or learning of networks procedure by increasing the noise level of the network, or varying the noise level, increasing the noise level in this case in this network. So in this case, it was stochastic resonance, so the noise was coming from the outside, and actually the noise was music, and quite many types of music, excluding the Schoenberg's music or the atonal music, are called pink noise. And pink noise is a noise when the frequency and the interruptions, so the tuning actually of the music is distributed by a scale-free degree, by a scale-free distribution, which means that from 100 times louder noise or music, you have 100 times less in the music, but not zero. From a quite soft music, you have quite high amount, but the distribution is a scale-free distribution, which means that if you have 10 times less, then you have 10 times smaller probability, and if you have 10 times more, then you have a 10 times higher probability. Much of the music is like this, and that's why we call them pink noise. So all of these dynamic structures changes which have this distribution, scale-free distribution, are called pink noise. And if you have the regular noise, so the hertz noise, the background noise, that we call white noise. So it's not pink noise, it's white noise. It doesn't have a scale-free distribution. So it is just random. I mean, random noise is white noise. So if you have a pink noise, then actually this is focusing your attention. If you have a relatively easy task, if you have a very difficult task, then it might not focus your attention that much. That was the observation, what they observed. But you may also observe it if you are listening to music, or you like to listen to music when you are preparing to your exams. You may observe that actually when you are preparing for a not so difficult exam, then listening to music is quite okay. But if you are preparing for a very difficult exam, I was preparing, for example, for exams in mathematics, and when I was preparing for them, then I wasn't able to listen to music, because then music was actually disturbing me, because for me, mathematics was a difficult task. For you, might be a different thing, a difficult task, but this is also quite general. Now, the next slide shows you self-organized criticality, which is or everyday avalanches. Now, why is it an avalanche? What is an avalanche? Actually, the sandpile avalanches, so if you have a sandpile and you are powering or dropping grains of sand to the top of the sandpile continuously, it will change. Obviously, sometimes the grain of sand, what you have just dropped to the top of this sand pile, will remain at the top. quite many times it will move down on the sand pile, but the distance from the top, how much it was moving down, is variable. Quite many times it will move down only little. 10 times higher variability or probability, it will move 10 times lower probability, it will move 10 times longer, so towards the bottom of the sand pile. At 100 times lower probability, it will go forward 100 times larger distance, so to the very bottom of the sand pile. And even avalanches are occurring, so quite many times if you are powering dropping one grain of sand to the top of the sand pile, then only a few grains will be changed. So this single one which you put to the top, or some more, like a few more. Occasionally, 10 times lower probability, there is a 10 times higher number of grains which are changing positions in their sand pile. So we have a small avalanche in the sand pile. This 10 times lower probability, so 100 times lower probability altogether now, you have a 100 times higher avalanche. But this is not a zero probability. So quite rarely you have huge avalanches in the sand pile. Actually, quite rarely you have huge avalanches in the snow in the high mountains. Not always. Quite sometimes you have small avalanches which you don't even consider an avalanche. It is not dangerous. Rarely you have a medium size of avalanche which might be considered as dangerous if you are just in the middle of it. And very rarely you have a huge avalanche which can actually carry away villages or even small towns, perhaps. So this is actually a regular distribution of various events which are happening randomly one after the other, or not only randomly, but actually the success of the first event is determining the start of the second event. If the grain was moving one step, then there is a chance that it will move another step, but that chance is limited. And if it had moved two steps already, there is a chance that it will move a third step, but it is also limited. So we have a large list of events which is behaving similarly, and I just gave you this: earthquakes, for example, volcano eruptions, forest fires, cracks, breath, rain, and so on, cultural changes, innovations. So this is a continuously increasing tension in that particular situation, and it is a partially restricted relaxation which is going on, and that is an avalanche actually. And self-organized criticality is kind of a procedure when the system is resetting itself by these avalanches. So the next slide shows you some cascading failures. And one of the examples is happening in the electricity network of the United States quite a few years ago, and there was a great blackout in a large segment of the United States actually, and it was occurring quite many times a few decades ago when the power network of the United States wasn't in such a good shape like now. What is this? It is becoming an avalanche because one of the power cords which are connecting to power stations in the United States or anywhere else is broken because of rain or because of just usage. It was becoming too old, or there was a tree which was falling onto it, or any other things might happen. There was a small earthquake, and so on. And if it is breaking, then the neighboring cords, the neighboring wires, which were transmitting the electricity in this power grid, are overloaded because they have to transmit a larger amount of electricity. So there is a chance that they will break because they will be overheated, for example. And if it occurs, so after the first break, there is a second break. Then the chance that there will be a third break, it is becoming higher because the overload of the neighboring nodes is becoming higher. And if there were 10 breaks already, then the chance that there will be an 11th break, it is very high because then the overload is getting very, very high in the neighborhood. So this is like an avalanche. Quite many times it is just restricted to a single break. But there are chances that it is going forward and it is making a larger blackout in a larger area. And even more rarely, it is making a blackout in a whole state of the United States or a whole region of the United States. So this is again a cascading failure with a scale-free distribution. Now, there might be weak points in networks, which you can see in the next slide. And actually, I'm showing you the famous paper, early paper, like 20 years ago, of Rico Albert and colleagues, Laszlo Barabási, for example, about the vulnerability of networks. And they demonstrated that scale-free degree distribution, having hubs in the networks, are making the networks resistant against failures, which are random failures, random attacks. But they are vulnerable to targeted attacks when the attacks are going against the hubs in the network, obviously, because then the network will be decomposed very, very soon. Now, if we are going a little one step forward in the network dynamics, and you should observe that now we are reached the network dynamics point, so this is about the dynamics of networks and not the structure of networks any longer, then we can see the topological phase transitions of networks, and it is at the next slide. When there is a topological phase transition going on from one network to another, then the network is changing its topology, its structure, and it is becoming a different type of network from all of a sudden by few changes in the structure. So when there is a little amount of stress or a large amount of resources, then networks are usually building a random graph. Just think about yourself. If you have ample resources, what is your resource? For example, time, lifetime. Your lifetime is one of your most precious resources. If you would know that you will live only 1 week more, then you would very much considering this last week of yours, what would you do? Whom you would like to meet in your last week of your life? Whom you would not? But if on the contrary, you would be granted that, listen, I am giving you 1 billion years now, and you can live for 1 billion years, then you wouldn't really considering whom you would meet in the next week. I mean, if I missed someone, I'm not caring. I mean, I will meet him or her later on. I have 1 billion years. Considering if he or she has 1 billion years as well. So if you have ample resources, then your priorities will not be that high. Because, well, I can do anything what I want. So why should I prioritize my tasks? I'm doing what I wish or what comes to my mind at this very moment. I'm not prioritizing my tasks. I don't have to prioritize my tasks because I have ample resources. Now, if you have less resources or larger amounts of stress in your system, then you are building up a scale-free network. Then you will becoming having hubs in the network, and there is a scale-free degree distribution which is occurring. There will be nodes which have few neighbors, and there will be nodes which have large amount of neighbors. There is a prioritization which is going on in neighbor finding in this network. Then you have a larger amount of stress or smaller amount of resources, then the network will become a star network. This is when the network will become very hierarchical. This is when the ancient Rome was electing a dictator. This is when there is a trouble in the network and we have to solve it very efficiently. This is why the network is becoming a very hierarchical network. In the most extremity, it will become a star network, which means that there is a central hub in the network and every one of the nodes is connected to this central hub, either directly or indirectly. Finally, if there is an even larger stress or smaller resources, then the network is decomposed. The giant component of the network is coming to an end. It is stopping to be existing, and subgraphs are developing. Subgraphs are small fragments of the giant component of the network, which was there previously, and these are well connected small segments of the network. Just think about a war situation when you, never experienced that, I hope or I wish, but when you have to escape. In a war, people are not escaping in hundreds, but they are not also escaping alone. They are escaping in small groups, in two-member groups, three-member groups, or maximally four-member groups, like a family, for example. So small subsections of the graph of the original social networks are still becoming coherent, actually much more coherent than before. But the large social network will become broken at this very extreme situation. Now I'm giving you in the next slide some other examples of topological phase transitions. I'm just giving you one of these many, which is the animals, the decays of the lions. If you are a lion, then you have ample resources, then you can have any prey what you wish, then you can have any type of meal for your breakfast or lunch or dinner, whatever you wish, because you are the strongest animal and almost the fastest animal in the region. However, in Africa, in some rare occasions, the only food what remains to a certain population of lions is a certain antelope. But that type of antelope is actually faster than the lions. Oops, that's a trouble, because the lions cannot reach the antelopes. And since the antelopes were remaining the only food source at that particular time for the lions, the lions are becoming hungry if they are not thinking about something. So formerly, in most of the cases, in all of the cases actually, the lions are forming a random social network. They are not really caring about prioritization. Who is the boss? Who is the subordinate? But in this particular case, when the only food source which is left is the antelope, which is faster than the lions, then in this case the lions are organizing themselves. This is the only case when they have to. So what actually happens? There is becoming a boss in the lions, and this boss is organizing the lions to two groups. One group of the lions is chasing the antelopes. The other group of the lions is hiding itself in front of the antelopes. So the group of lions which is chasing the antelopes is chasing the antelopes towards the other group of the lions, which will catch the lions finally, the antelopes finally, and well, they will eat them together. So this is the only case or only occasion when the lions are organizing themselves to a scale-free degree distribution, having a hub, having a boss lion who is organizing this whole enterprise or procedure, and having all the other lions as subordinates. And now the only other case when the lions are organizing themselves, when the lions are attacked by a neighboring lion group. Then again, the hub is becoming a hub. It is organizing the defense, and they are defending themselves. This is happening much more frequently with the monkeys. Monkeys are having a random network in most of the cases. Again, But if the monkeys are attacked by a neighboring monkey group, which is much, much frequently happening than with lions, because lions are living sparsely enough, monkeys are not, then the monkeys are organizing themselves very well. And there are few monkeys who are hiding the small children, there are few monkeys who are fighting, there are few monkeys who are organizing them. And there is a wise old monkey who is designing all this procedure because he was surviving several of these attacks, and he or she is knowing what to do. So this is a very wise and tricky organization of the monkey society, and it is very flexible. Now, the next slide shows you synchronization, which was observed by Huygens. Huygens was a famous scientist of the 17th century, and at the time the Royal Society of England, the United Kingdom, was offering a very high price for a person who was designing a very precious, very precise clock. Why the hell the United Kingdom needed a precise clock? Why would they be happy to pay a large amount of money for a very precise clock? Well, this was because of the sailors and the navy of the United Kingdom at the time, because in the 17th century the navy of the United Kingdom was finding treasures all around the world, making colonies all around the world in ample sources. So they hadn't enough ships to ship these treasures around the world to London or to other cities of the United Kingdom. So they had to learn, or they had to remember, where they were hiding the rest of the treasures in some remote regions of the world. Now, for this, you need distance, very precisely determined, and a latitude and a longitude, very precisely determined. Now, one of them can be determined very precisely using the stars, using the position of the stars, but the other one can be determined using a very precise clock, and that's what they missed. So they weren't able to determine their correct position precisely enough to find their treasures, and that was very costly. And therefore they figured out that we need a very precise clock, much more precise than the clocks were at the time. And they were offering a high price for any scientist who is offering them the solution for this problem. And Huygens was actually developing the pendulum clock. And you may remember the pendulum clock from your grandparents' or great-grandparents' living room. And even in your living room, there might be a pendulum clock if you are liking old stuff. And it is quite precise, not as precise, obviously, as quartz clocks, but at the time of Huygens, mankind didn't have quartz clocks. So the most precise clock what they had was the pendulum clock. So Huygens was actually the person who was inventing the pendulum clock. And he was becoming sick, and he was laying in his bed, and there were some pendulum clocks already hanging on his wall, and he was watching these pendulum clocks, and as you may remember, these pendulum clocks are just clicking, like click, clack, click, clack, click, clack, and he was just listening to these voices and watching these clocks in his bed. And all of a sudden he realized that these clocks were synchronizing themselves. So this very unexpected thing happened, that one of the clocks was clicking like this, that click, 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 and the other one was starting to click in the same frequency and in the same way. Click, 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 click. And all of a sudden, in a gradual manner, all the clocks were becoming synchronized. And all of them were clicking in the same way, and well, this was like a miracle. I mean, how could they tell each other that I am clicking this way and you are clicking that way? And finally, Huygens was figuring out that there are very, very tiny noises, very tiny vibrations, which are produced, obviously, by these clocks while they are clicking. That's why you can hear them. And these tiny vibrations were shared by the clocks, actually, via the building, via the wall on which they were put. And this is how they could communicate with each other, and this is how they could actually be synchronized. So first, Huygens was sending the invention of the pendulum clock to the Royal Society, and the Royal Society members were very much pleased because they realized that this is really a very precise clock. So they were actually considering to give the prize to Huygens because they were just waiting for some other solutions, but they haven't got any better. But a year later, or half a year later, I mean, the mail was going back and forth very unfrequently at the time. Huygens was sending them another letter. This is why actually we call the papers in the paper of Nature, which is the best scientific paper or journal of the world. Well, science is almost that good, but Nature is considered to be the best. Because originally these scientific observations were actually sent as letters, and Huygens was sending his second letter to the Royal Society, and the second letter contained that he was observing this synchronization of the pendulum clocks, and he was very much pleased to get this observation and to get the explanation for that, and he was thinking that he will get a very pleasing answer to this scientific discovery. Now, the answer was disappointing, because the answer was that, Mr. Huygens, we received your first letter with the invention of the pendulum clock, and we were very much pleased that this is a very precise clock. But then we received your second letter saying that these pendulum clocks are synchronizing themselves with these tiny, tiny, tiny vibrations. And we were thinking about that these clocks have to be used at ships on the sea when there are large storms. And if tiny, tiny vibrations are changing the clicking of these clocks, then the storms at the sea will make them unusable, so you will not get the prize. And Huygens was so much pissed off, and he was so much disappointed that he was completely finishing his area of science for his life, and he was never thinking again about clocks or pendulums or synchronization or anything related, because he was so much disappointed by not getting the prize. But unrelated to this, synchronization occurs very frequently. Crickets are producing their voice in a synchronized manner. Fireflies in many, many areas of the world, actually in the Philippines, for example, where I could observe this special type of fireflies, they are blinking in a synchronized manner. So there are several thousand, ten thousands of fireflies on the same tree, and they are blinking in the same synchronized manner. So they are visible from miles away. And they are attracting females. These are male fireflies, so they are attracting female fireflies for a large distance. And if they would blink, one of them would blink just alone, lonely, or they would blink randomly, then they wouldn't attack that many females from a large distance. And despite they are many in that tree, many more females are coming because of this trick, and they are well off. Many other events like clapping, yawning, and even menstruation could be synchronized if people are or the producers are closed to a certain neighborhood, and they are able to synchronize this within each other. So even diseases like venereal diseases can be synchronized, and this can actually give you a tool to fight against these diseases. Now any transmittable disease can do that, as we could see it in these waves of this coronavirus infection, for example, in 2020 or now in 2021. Now, the synchronization conditions are the following. If the network is a small world, then it can be synchronized very well. If the network has modules, then the modules are distanced from each other, so separated from each other, so the synchronization occurs not that frequently. If the network is carefree, then hubs are filters of this information transmission, as I told you before, similarly as modules, so the synchronization cannot occur that easily. If the network is weighted, then synchronization can occur more easily. And if distant regions of the network are connected by weak links, then again, the synchronization can occur more frequently. So this is an interesting feature of networks, and it's very important to observe these synchronization events. Now, as the last part of this lecture, I'm showing you this table, which is giving you an account about the differences between engineering and evolution. On the middle column, you see the engineered products, and here the engineered products are engineered products of the 19th century. So engineered products in the old sense of engineering, like the coffee grinder of your grandmother. On the right figure or right column, you see the evolution, the properties of the evolution. The development, in case of engineering, needs designer input, obviously, the input of the engineer. Why the evolution is a self-organization process. It is just growing. Connection of the parts of the and the whole, the relationship of the parts of the whole is additive in case of engineering, and it's becoming a complicated system. And it is non-additive, it cannot be calculated as an addition in case of evolution, and it is becoming a complex systems. Complex systems cannot be calculated by simple additions of the properties of their segments, because they are producing novelty as the segments are added together. Optimization is going piece by piece in case of engineering, and optimization in case of evolution is continuous. Evolution optimizes the whole system at the same time. It cannot optimize only the parts, because the whole system is living. The whole system is participating in the communication with the environment. So only the whole system can be optimized at one given time. Therefore, the optimized parameters are few in case of the classical engineering, and there are many in case of evolution. The intermediates are many times virtual in the engineering. I mean, you are just drawing them in your engineering table or in your board. But in evolution, all the intermediates need to be stable. They need to be viable. They need to survive. So this is a major difference between evolution and engineering. Evolution is much more restricted, because all the intermediates have to be viable. And this is why the whole can be optimized only, because all the time the whole has to be viable, has to survive. Now, the designability is a number which tells you that how many ways that particular organization can be designed. If the organization that wiring the network of that particular structure is very simple, it can be designed only in one way. If it is a hierarchical network with the minimal number of edges, then that's it. You cannot make any alternative design of it. That's the design. So the designability is one. If it is a complex network, then the designability is much higher than one. It has many configurations, many possibilities, many possibilities for changing, actually. And the network, after certain small changes, will remain the same. It is not changing its properties despite of some changes in its structure. So the designability is more than one in this case. The elements, the nodes of an engineering network, are usually isolated, relatively isolated, and they have themselves a low complexity. In case of evolution, the nodes, the elements, the segments are not isolated. Just think about our organs. Our organs are not isolated from each other, and they can be fairly independent from each other. So, it might happen that you have an inflammation in your bowel, but you don't have, fortunately, an inflammation in your brain. Poor you if you would have an inflammation in your bowel, in your heart, and in your brain at the same time. You would die. But fortunately, these are pretty much isolated from each other, and therefore the inflammation is staying in one of them and could be isolated there. But these organs, these segments of an evolutionary structure, are complex themselves. A heart is very much is a complex organ. A brain is even much more complex organ. So they have complexity by themselves. Now, the degeneracy is again a feature of systems, and if the degeneracy is low, that means that the system is behaving only one way. If you change the system, then it will behave in a different way. If the degeneracy is high, then you can reach the same behavior in the system by using several configurations. So the degeneracy is very much related to the designability of the system, and if the designability is low, then the degeneracy is also low. If the designability is high, in case of evolution, then the degeneracy is also high. Now, if the degeneracy is low, then the system is thrifty. It is very efficient. Engineered systems are usually efficient. This is actually an output of the engineering process. Design as efficient system as you can, because we have a limited resource, or we don't want to waste that much resources for that system. In case of evolution, this is not a problem. Mitochondria are producing a vast amount of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine triphosphate is giving a vast amount of energy for our life. It is much, much more what we can actually use up. So we have ample resources in our body, unless we are starving, unless we are dying, unless we are very old. But usually, if we are young or if we are healthy, then we have ample resources in our body. So we can overspend. We don't have to be thrifty. The design can have a high degeneracy. It may have a high complexity. It may have a high designability. And therefore, the engineering product is having a low survival in case of unexpected changes. But the evolutionary product is having a high survival in case of unexpected cases because of a high degeneracy. Because in unexpected cases, it is still having a behavior which is different from the behavior from the last behavior, but it is a valid behavior. It will be a solution for that problem, so it will survive. Now, this is connecting actually the case of the unexpected changes and the case of the intermediates. In the intermediates, they do not need to be viable in case of engineering. They have a low survival in unexpected changes. The intermediates has had to be viable in case of evolution. They have a high survival. I'm just giving you the example of an airplane. If an airplane is having an unexpected case, which is a terrorist, then the airplane will not survive. Well, we have many terrorists in our body. Actually, now, for example, the coronavirus is unfortunately, a great enough terrorist in our body. But many people are fortunately surviving that still. And if we have other infections, then we are surviving at an even higher rate. So believe me that you are having quite many infections at this time. Fortunately, or hopefully not the coronavirus, but others. And you don't even care. You don't even observe them. You are surviving them. You are designed very well. Your designability is high. Your degeneracy is high in this manner. And therefore, you can change your behavior despite of these small terrorists which are inside you and which are disturbing your body function at this very moment. So this is the major difference between evolution and engineering, and this is the end of my lecture. Thank you very much, and see you in the next lecture, which will be already the fifth lecture of this series.